Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Great to have him back and great to have you listening in as well. And certainly if you have a question for Phil about an insect, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
What are you getting for questions these days in your office? I know you get a lot of them at the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Well, two things. I just got back from our national entomological meetings, and to be honest, by far the biggest topic there was bed bugs. And although I don't quite feel like my colleagues in New York, it is something that I see on a very regular basis now. And the other thing is, because of the time of the year, there's a lot of critters that have snuck into people's houses to spend the winter, and then you get the right warm day or whatnot, and they wake up. So box elder bugs and cluster flies and Asian lady beetles, although their numbers were down quite a bit this year. There's a little critter associated with hackberry trees called a psyllid that will get in your screens and kind of wake up. So that's been kind of the biggest combination, although I did get a call about cutworms on the snow. Maybe we can talk about that a little later.
Oh, all right. Well, Pat in Green Bay, I think, has something relating to those lady beetles. So let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat.
Oh, hi. Yes, you don't think of bugs when it's this cold and snowy, but in our house, we were rummaging in unheated attic space, and we noticed a big cluster of those Asian lady beetles hiding behind a board. And then, we did our work in the attic. We were storing things away, looking for Christmas items. And about two or three days later, we noticed these beetles now crawling around in the house. Like, we let them loose, and I was wondering, what's the magic behind these critters and other bugs? How can they survive this long in the cold conditions?
I mean, they use a couple tricks. They honestly get their internal antifreeze up to the level so their body doesn't freeze. Other ones go through a process called supercooling, where they don't allow ice to form within their bodies. But insects being cold-blooded, basically if the temperature is below about 45 degrees, they're not moving. I mean, metabolically, they just can't do anything. But the interesting thing with something like an Asian lady beetle is you can pull him from 5 degrees and he's totally inactive, and you get him to a warm situation, let him warm up and get his body temperature up, and they start moving right away. And so that's typical of insects that have prepared for the winter. If you took an Asian lady beetle in the middle of the summer and exposed him to 5 degrees, it would probably kill him. But as I said, insects that have a chance to get their body metabolism set up go through this dormant time when it's cold, but if they're warmed up, they can wake up. And that's the phenomenon we see with a lot of these, what we call fall invaders.
There you go. There you go. Thanks, Pat. Judy and Ripon, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying to get on this show for such a long time to ask this question. And he had mentioned cluster flies at the beginning of the show. I have a cottage in southwestern Wisconsin that stays closed up for a month at a time, and then, once a month or so we get there. And it's next to a farm, and I always assumed that it was the farm, but now I'm starting to think that maybe it's not. We have such a problem in the fall with those flies coming in and dying, and then every time we come there, we have to sweep up piles of flies, and it's disgusting. And mm-hmm. we have Orkin coming on a regular basis just to deal with insects and spiders and mice and things like that that get into, cottages that are closed up for periods of time. They just haven't seemed to address the problem. I don't know if someone had told me once that you need to bore holes into the ceiling and spray up into the ceiling.
No. I think it's worth talking to them about what they're doing exactly, because the treatment you have for general pests is different than the treatment you do for cluster flies. Cluster flies is a very seasonal thing. It should go on sometime in September, I would think. And all the treatment should be done on the outside of the structure. They treat especially the south side and up in the soffits and the places where these things will sneak in. And the whole trick is you get them before they get in. Once they've squeezed into a structure, then you pay for it for the rest of the winter, and there really isn't anything that's very effective. And so, as I said, I think it'd be worth talking to them, because the monthly service that they typically would do would not address it. It's not meant to address it, because they're just spraying the baseboards and around the door frames and that kind of thing. And as I said, this is really a general surface treatment, and it's only one treatment a year for it. But if you miss the window, unfortunately, you can't catch up.
So when is the window?
In September, because that's when they're starting to migrate in. And Asian lady beetles a little later, that's usually into early October. But I usually, somewhere around the 15th of September, I'd be comfortable with the treatment going on.
Okay.
And And then, you know, you could argue that for the rest of the winter, you know, why treat? Because there's nothing migrating in, there's nothing breeding. And so, you know, if we were in Florida where there's a constant pressure with insects, you can justify a monthly treatment. I just am not very excited about that strategy in Wisconsin unless it's a very specialized situation.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Judy, for calling. And Shirley in Prentice, it's your turn. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Larry. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Phil. Is there any company working on getting a pesticide for the bed bugs, or coming any close to getting something? And I did think of a second question while I was waiting. Are the bed bugs affected by temperature as the lady beetles are?
Well, yes. I mean, they're inactive, but they cannot survive. What's interesting, the strategy they're using now, because we're having trouble with the chemicals working much at all, is they're using heat treatments. And you can kill any bed bug at 112 degrees, which is a weakness that the bed bug will always have. And so there are people that come in with machines that heat generate 140 degrees air temperature, and you basically cook them out. People have looked at cold. Cold is a little trickier because it's not any given temperature, other than I can tell you it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 12 degrees minus Fahrenheit. I can kill any bed bug and its eggs, instant freeze. But above that temperature, it depends on what the bed bug has seen and how long you have it there. And so it gets more difficult if you had a couch that was infested to get the center of the couch to minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, so just putting it out in the garage or out in a cold night doesn't guarantee that that's going to work, because bed bugs can survive really amazingly well below freezing for hours, if not days, depending on the situation. The chemical side, you know, there are chemicals that have some, you know, there's a whole economic side here of trying to develop chemicals, what it would cost to develop it, to get it registered. There's some discussion that some of the chemicals that used to be used up until about 5 years ago in the indoors could be brought back. There are chemicals that are still used out in the garden and in for vegetable production, and but EPA as of yet has not released that, although it's in discussion. So, you know, a lot of things going on. I will tell you after this meeting, you know, I've come to the conclusion, as many people have, there's really three parts to the bed bug story. The resistance makes them very difficult to control with chemicals. Not impossible, but very difficult. One of it has to do with resources. It is an expensive treatment. And you have situations where people just don't have the money to get it treated properly. And one of it is an educational problem in that, you know, you've got to be very careful not to have bed bugs hide out in a suitcase or a backpack, and you go stay somewhere else when the treatment's done, and you bring it back and you've reintroduced the bed
bugs.
And so, you know, some of it's a public education side. And even if people are given the rules, they don't always follow them. So when you put that combination together, the resource aspect, the resistance aspect, and the people aspect, it looks like it's going to be a very difficult problem for a long time to come.
Yeah. Simon had emailed in and wondered, he travels around the world on various things, and he's been bitten by bed bugs even in London. He wondered what they look like and how do you spot them in a bed. You know, he's going to a lot of hotels and stuff. So,
well, an adult bed bug is about a quarter inch long, and it reminds me of an apple seed in color, in size, and shape.
Huh.
You know, they're kind of a chestnutty brown in color. They're a little bit more pointed in the end. They're very flattened, which allows them to hide out. Very small bed bugs, though, are almost, you know, like a small sesame seed, and they're almost more a yellowish color. So they vary, and it depends on their feeding status. What you will find is you tend to look at seams of things, and I like to look at wood. They seem to have a real fondness for wood. So headboards, and another common place to look for them is on the box spring, where there's that little piece of wood that everything is on the frame.
Yeah.
Look right in that kind of corner, and one of the things that they leave behind that's always going to be there are these little black waste spots. They're almost like little tar spots, although they're dull. They're not shiny. And so that's often a dead giveaway. When you look in the seams of things and find these dark spots or underneath a picture frame or in back of a headboard, then you know that there have been bed bugs present. Same thing on a mattress. You look where the piping is. They usually hide there. When they hide on a suitcase, you see the same thing. They're along the zipper seam. They're along a folded piece of fabric, because that's where they want to spend most of their time. So in a sense, it's somewhat like cockroaches, except they're small. They can get into smaller seams. So, you know, it is... you know, one of the things we're all going to have to do is change our behavior, because none of us grew up dealing with bed bugs. None of us really have them on our radar screen. But now I think we're getting to the point when people go to hotels, they should do an inspection before they put their stuff down. They should put their suitcase in places where the bed bugs are not likely to get it. I love the bathtub as a place because then it's protected. But at minimum, keep it away from the bed, keep it away from other furniture, keep it off the ground. Those are things that will lessen the chance of you bringing them home with you.
Let's turn to Fred in New Berlin next. Hi, Fred.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My question is not with bed bugs, but with fleas, which I find in the beds in Guatemala. And I was wondering if there's something I could spray or take along with me to protect me from the fleas.
You know, one of the things you might consider is, you know, they sell this bed netting that is insecticide treated for mosquito control. You know, this is being used in Africa and elsewhere for to protect human health. And netting like that would also work. The permethrin that's impregnated there would both repel and kill anything like that. So that would be something to consider, maybe as easy as anything. You know, you hate to put chemicals on the mattress that you sleep in the like, and so you're somewhat restricted there. You know, if it was your own home, I would tell you the vacuum cleaner is probably one of the best defenses against knocking down adult fleas. But I'm not sure you want to travel with a small vac in your suitcase. So as I said, I think would consider getting one of these chemically treated bed nets and drape it over the bed, and that will protect you not with just fleas and some other critters. Although, back to the bed bug story.
Yeah.
I was on a program with a colleague from Florida who does a lot of research, and there are some people that think the reason we have so much resistance problem with bed bugs is because they have been exposed to these permethrin-treated bed nets in Africa and elsewhere over the years. And when you expose an insect to low dosages of chemicals constantly, that's how you develop resistance. And so this gentleman even called it was his Bill Gates theory, because Bill Gates has been promoting this. And, of course, it's done lots of good things with lessening malaria transmission. But it's an interesting theory. I don't think they'll ever prove it, but that does make a lot of sense, because somewhere or another, these bed bugs, again, have developed just an incredible resistance to the dominant chemicals that we're using indoors.
Well, thank you very much for...
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Fred. Appreciate it. Chuck emailed in, could you ID, it's a strange bee or wasp that had red markings on it, about the size of a bumblebee. And that's all he gave us. That's not a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't jump out at me. You know, if it was fuzzy, at least we know it's in the bee group. If it appeared not to have much in the way of hairs on the body, that would make it a wasp. You know, there's so darn many of them. You know, we have over 400 species of native bees in the state alone, but lots of dark, large things, but the red is what's throwing me off. I can't think of right off the top anything with the red markings.
All right. Let's go to Pete in La Crosse then. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Hey, we have an attached lean-to greenhouse, and as you can imagine, we have ants of many different species living in the floor. I want to quick tell you what the floor is, because I have a follow-up question. But it's 2-inch thick pavers with 5 inches of crushed rock or screenings under that, and then a layer of sand about 1 inch thick with PEX tubing in it. Anyhow, so I get all kinds of ants living in the screenings or maybe down to the sand layer that are mining up the contents and causing the pavers to sink, etc. So I'm wondering, what can I do to get the ants to live somewhere else? And in particular, what will happen in March when we start putting heat into that PEX tubing and we start making that floor nice and toasty warm?
Well, you'll get early activity. You might even get swarming, which is the process where all the wing forms come bubbling up out of the ground. The problem with ants... is that in a colony, which may have thousands of individuals, there is a queen. And in some species, there's more than one queen. But when you talk about ant control, you have to kill the queen. And so in this situation, if you just sprayed in the cracks where the ants have been active and whatnot, you may get the ants quieting down for a short period of time, but you really never kill them. All you do is knock off a few workers, which can be replaced quite easily. And so the secret with ant control is to somehow get the product to them. And so if there's enough spacing in the pavers that you can drench, you know, basically pour stuff in that will soak deep, this is going to be the whole secret. Now, if there's enough spacing in the pavers that you can put some kind of rod or something else to tunnel so that you're basically making a deep indentation into that gravel. So all we're trying to do is get this stuff as deep as we possibly can get, because that's where the queen's going to be found. And so, you know, if you see a pile of dirt in a corner, you get right in that center of that pile. As I said, if you can put a small rod, if it can fit down in there so that you make a channel, and then pour your already dilute product, and I would use just a small pail or a cup to get the product down, that's where you'll get the best bang for your buck as far as treatment. So you don't do a general broadcast treatment. You kind of spot treat the areas the ants are showing activity, and you're hoping that the colony is located directly underneath it. What's going to complicate this is that, you know, there are areas of the paver you can't get to. But I think you can make a big difference. I don't know if you can. I can guarantee you you're going to get rid of them all. But, you know, there's a lot of ants that typically would live under rocks anyway. So you've got a good environment to begin with. It's very well drained. That's much in their favor also. You know, and then when you add heat, you're going to extend their yeah. activity pattern by 2 or 3 months. Is what I'm guessing.
Okay, then are they likely to move into the house, or are they more inclined to stay in the greenhouse?
It depends on the kind of ant. I think that you probably have cornfield ants. They don't have a lot of interest in people food. You may have pavement ants. They will occasionally come in looking for food. But if you have something like yellow ants or citronella ants, they have no interest in coming in for food. So I think it's more of a nuisance problem is what I would anticipate than really a problem with them coming in the kitchen and eating food.
Okay. All right.
Okay, very good.
Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, and if there's any doubt, send me some ants. I mean, usually if I know what kind of ant it is, the other avenue that it does open it up is baiting. But we have to know what the ant is and know what the proper baits are.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. We'll turn to Eric in Appleton next. Eric, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. One more big question and a quick last question. On these airline magazines, I see these portable UV lights to kill bed bugs where you're supposed to run them over your sheets. Is that effective? And then also the wasp question. Twice I've seen paper wasp nests that looks like they were eaten. Do mice or something do battle with paper wasps? Or what would eat a paper wasp nest?
Boy, skunks, raccoons, or mice. It's a good protein source. And so if it's really tore up, I would think it would be a skunk or a raccoon more likely. Now, the UV stuff, unfortunately, no. I have seen no evidence of UV. Steam, you know, steam cleaners would be a way of physically killing them. They also sell liquid nitrogen. These are more used commercially, yeah. So they're freezing them on that side. So there are some things, but as I said, if it was that easy, it would be a lot easier to control, but we're just not seeing those. Ozone has some interest, but the problem seems to be with ozone is generating enough of a concentration. And, you know, some of the chemical or units that they're used for mold remediation and whatnot apparently aren't generating enough ozone to kill the bed bugs. So that one has looked promising, but, and then there's also a concern, I think, is people have to be concerned about their exposure to large levels of ozone. So that, I think, is one of the things that's stopping that from being totally developed.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Don in West Salem, hi.
Yes, hi. Kind of a couple of questions. One, you were talking about bed bugs and fleas and stuff. And I was wondering, do those ultrasonic repellers that you plug in for bugs and spiders and mice and whatever, and they're supposed to be good for a room or whatever, do those do any good?
No.
They don't.
I wish they did, but no. As I said, all the science I have seen behind it, cockroaches, whatnot, are really not affected at all. Sometimes you see, I know with rodents, there has been a short behavior change, but when they're on for a long period of time, the rodents learn that this is not a problem, and they adjust to it too. So as I said, they really, even though they keep selling them in all kinds of units, and I know Dr. Craven's talked on the wildlife side of things too, and they're just not seeing any positive effects, but they keep getting sold.
Yeah.
Okay, is there anything that can be used in a house to get rid of things like that where you have birds and cats and dogs?
So you have birds and cats and dogs in the house.
Yeah. I mean, for specific problems, there are chemicals that can be used around those animals. I mean, birds are probably the most sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the thing that we tend to see with homeowners is there are products that you can get at the local, you know, hardware stores and whatnot that would be very suitable. But the one thing that we see people do not do is read the directions. And when you don't read the directions, then the chance of complications really get up there. And so some chemicals, you have to be very restricted where you can apply them. And in this case, in particular, to protect your pets. The other side of it, though, you know, like we talked earlier, the person that said that they were getting their place treated on a regular basis, you know, I'm more kind of a get a problem and react to it. As far as using preventative stuff, we really don't find that either works very well or it's a very wise thing to do. So, as I said, you know, if you have a specific spider problem, you know, we could talk about you can vacuum for them, you can spot treat corners with particular products. But as far as general spraying and whatnot all over the place to use that as solving it really isn't a very good strategy.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And we turn to Lou in Rosendale next. Hi, Lou.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have bed bugs both in my home in Wisconsin and in Florida that I picked up in motels on the way and was too naive to realize what it was. But I've heard that diatomaceous earth may kill the bed bugs. Is that a possible solution? And if so, where does one obtain that product?
It is, but it's just a tool that needs to be used with other things. Diatomaceous earth is an abrasive product. There's also synthetic versions like silica aerogel and a product called Dryone Dust. I have seen it even at some garden stores. The problem is how it's formulated, the size of the dust, because the dust that is often used for treating vegetables and outside really isn't very effective. And here's a case, too, where people don't, you know, what people will do sometimes is buy diatomaceous earth and they'll put an inch wide ring all around their bed on the outside. And to be honest, that's a totally ineffective way of applying it. Yeah. Where diatomaceous earth works is to have a very fine powder or dust of it and you spray it back into voids, into spaces where the bed bugs are hiding. And then when the bed bugs walk through it, it abrades them. So it's really very effective in those cases. But if you have, let's say, a box spring, you would have to totally disassemble it and basically spray it in all the cracks and crevices to be effective.
Oh, boy.
And that's, you know, I think people think that this is, you know, the one solution. I put a little diatomaceous earth and the bed bugs will be gone. As I said, it's very effective in some environments. But if somebody had a very large infestation and they wanted to get after it, I think there's some things that would work much quicker and are somewhat more reliable. But I do think diatomaceous earth and the other drying dusts are a very efficient tool and should be included in a lot of treatments.
So silica aerogel, and what else did you say?
There's a product called Dryone Dust. Dryone is pyrethrum, the natural insecticide, mixed with an abrasive. Now, these kinds of products, if you can't find them locally, are very readily available on the Internet. There are sites that sell you bed bug kits, so they'll sell you the mattress cover and the like. They'll sell you isopropyl alcohol as a contact spray. You can buy that at any store. That's not that big a deal. But they'll also sell you these dusts. One of the names that the diatomaceous earth is sold under is Mother Earth Dust. And this is a formulation that's very finely powdered. But you're also going to have to buy a bulb duster, a way of applying it, which is like a little bellows, and you put it in the reservoir and you blow it back into these corners. So as I said, it's worth, if you can't find it locally, go on the Internet. Some of these do your own pest control sites, and they will have all kinds of these kind of products available that they can mail to you.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And more callers online. Let's turn to Ruth in Madison next. Ruth, hi.
Oh, hello. The other fellow, your second last call, I guess, or third last, sort of stole my thunder when he asked about those electronic devices, which you said did not work, and I sort of thought that was the way it seemed likely to me. But I do have another question about spiders. I don't really have much of a problem with them, but if I try to get rid of them, where should I look for them? Usually I see them, like, right along the seam of the wall and the ceiling. And I'm thinking, as I see them, but where might they be hiding otherwise?
Well, you know, when you look at what there are different kinds of spiders that relate to their behavior. And most of the spiders we have indoors like to make little secluded retreats, little tunnels or little webs that they hide into and come out. And so you hit it right on the nose. corners, edges, if you've got a lot of boxes and things, you know, where one box meets the other, they're looking for those kind of retreats to make these little things. So not out in the open, it's always back in a corner, in a closet. And so that's why vacuuming, honestly, is quite effective. Is, you know, it's a bother to go through all those nooks and crannies, but when you put that attachment tool on that allows you to get back in those corners and suck them up, it really does make a big difference and is really as effective as any treatment I know.
So it would be along the floor line as well, not just high up?
Yes, possibly, although, I'd be more concerned in closets. I'd be more concerned in basements. Mm-hmm. A lot of spiders like the dampness in the basement to begin with. And then the thing to always think about is spiders have to eat insects. And so where do you find most of the insects? And the same thing, it's usually back in the corners. Sometimes you'll find them on window frames because they're catching insects that are attracted to light. In the basement, we got a lot of insects that squeeze underneath the siding and fall in the basement, and things like sow bugs and centipedes and the like. And so that's a common place to find the spiders. So the same thing, you go along the joists, you know, that's a great place for spiders to be. And as I said, if you were going to use treatments, various sprays and dusts, and some people argue the dusts are better than sprays because the dust gets on the web, and then when the spider re-eats the web to recycle it, that's how it gets exposed. But you have to use them the same way, as you got to get back in these retreats, in these hiding places. It's not very effective to put it out in the middle of your living space because that's not where the spider's going to be.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And Paul in Chicago, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Paul.
How do you do? It's nice to talk to you folks. I have a question about a product that years ago I found very, very super effective for roaches, ants, just anything, even bed bugs. And it was called back then Chinese chalk or magic chalk. And it seems that the pesticide or the... these industries, local industries that produce this stuff like Raid or what have you, got their lobbyists together and petitioned the federal government to outlaw it with an excuse that children were mistaking the Chinese chalk or what have you for candy or something, which I don't believe. It was just so effective mm-hmm. that they were losing business.
Well,
other products that children might mistake, but we don't just outlaw. You know, there's sharp knives, there's an X-lax.
Sure. Everything.
Well,
yeah.
the problem was the chemical was not registered in the United States. We found that, I remember when that first came out and somebody brought it in my lab, and we had no idea what the active ingredient was. And, you know, you put a little piece of chalk down, we expose some red flower beetles to it, and in about 20 seconds, they start to quiver. So we knew there was an insecticide. It turned out it was called deltamethrin, which is a chemical that is available at the hardware store in other formulations. But really what got them in trouble is it was not registered as a pesticide. In the United States, everything that's sold as a pesticide has to be registered with EPA. So this was more of a political problem, but it was showing up in specialty stores and places. People were importing it and technically importing it illegally. So that's the baseline. I will tell you now that the bed bugs are not affected by those kinds of chemicals. That's the problem we're having, is the pyrethroids aren't very effective. The cockroaches are. So as I said, if you really like that chemical, you can get aerosols, you can get liquid sprays, and you can get dusts that contain this deltamethrin is the active ingredient.
Deltamethrin.
Deltamethrin.
All right. There you go, Paul. Thank you for calling. Betsy in Fitchburg, hello to you.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm calling on behalf of my 11-year-old daughter, who's too shy to talk on the phone.
Okay.
She has heard about bees that will kind of do a little dance to communicate to each other on where to find pollen. And she was wondering if Asian ladybugs, lay beetles, do some sort of communication to let others know a good place to go. She'll see a couple bugs on a door, and then the next day it's completely covered.
Very good question. Honestly, there is no... I mean, bees and ants seem to have some very interesting ways of communicating. They're kind of at the top of the heap in the insect world. One of the things that we thought was going on with Asian lady beetle, which a lot of insects use, are chemicals that attract other insects. So we thought the first insects there would give off a chemical and the other ones would be drawn in. That turns out not to be the case with Asian lady beetle. It is with other things, but it turns out it's visual. And the experiments have shown, and you can see this, that when the sun hits your house, the south side of the house, all of a sudden it's like a light goes on and they're starting to be attracted to it. You come by the next day and it's cloudy, they're not there. in its visual contrast. And so basically by getting, you know, black and white parallel stripes, they found that that was the most attractive to it. And what often happens when the sun hits the house, there's also a shady area. So that's where we're getting the contrast, the sun and the shade.
Oh.
And so it's all visual.
Okay.
So, you know, and as I said, it differs for insects. We know that cockroaches give off chemicals that attract other cockroaches. Honestly, bedbugs give off chemicals that make them congregate to some degree. But in this case, with Asian lady beetle, it seems to be all visual, and they all seem to react to the same thing. And then if there's a place they can squeeze into, oh, they're happy as heck, because then they've got the shelter they're looking for. So,
great.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Betsy. Thank you for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@WPR.org. Again, it's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Joan in Milwaukee next. Hi, Joan.
Hello. I rarely wear winter coats anymore, and the other day I thought I would wear my beautiful fur and collar and winter coat, and I found little moth holes in it on the sleeve. What can I do about it, and does that mean there might be moths in the rest of the clothes that are stacked in there?
Well, there's two things that damage garments, clothes moths and carpet beetles, and their diet is very similar. They will feed on wool, they'll feed on silk, they'll feed on natural hair type things, you know, mohair, furs. They will not feed on cotton and other things, so you're somewhat restricted what they will be in. The individual garment, you know, it's hard for me to say without looking at. Usually, if you've got clothes moths, you find the little cases they leave behind next to the damaged areas. If it was carpet beetles, there's usually very little evidence. Cleaning the garment would kill anything that's there. What you have to be concerned about, what you find is things that you wear on a regular basis rarely get damaged. They don't like the light. They don't like to be out and exposed. It's usually when things are in storage and put away. So it's happening in the summer. It's happening when things are in the attic. Going through the items and just vacuuming, honestly, would dislodge a lot of things. You don't have to wash everything in sight. But I think now you're going to have to kind of keep your guard up. And so, you know, valuable pieces that you're putting away, consider putting them in very tight-fitting, you know, plastic containers. Put them away clean, put them in a tight container. Some people will even go as far as taping the container. It just depends how tight it fits. I think sometimes that's overkill. And that by itself would protect any of the other items from being affected. But I think it'd be worth examining very closely if you can see any evidence of the clothes moths concern me more than the carpet beetles. Everybody's got a couple carpet beetles in the house, and they just kind of once in a while get in trouble. But I'm definitely seeing a lot more clothes moth problems now in the last 5 to 10 years than I did earlier. And if undetected, they can cause problems in oriental rugs and, you know, all kinds of other things that are really quite valuable.
I know, but what do I do about the moth? Will it continue to chew away at this coat?
If you cleaned the coat, it would kill any moths that are on there, so you should be fine there. If you put it away in storage so they can't get to it, that would be another way of protecting it. Now, if you don't do anything and just let it hang there and you have a lot of closed moths in the house, yes, you'll continue to see damage. But I think it's pretty easy. Once you got your guard up, you should be able to stop it from happening.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary in Kenosha, we turn to you next. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Funny question for you. Has there been any research done as far as this bud bug question, as far as maybe, this is kind of goofy, but maybe introducing an infestation of spiders to eat the bed bugs, you know, similar to the idea with the Asian beetle with the aphids? Now hang up.
Yeah, they can't eat fast enough. I mean, the bed bugs outproduce what the spiders could handle. Plus, the spiders don't get back into the cracks and crevices enough. There is a creature called a type of assassin bug that I see more now than I used to, and I think this is not necessarily related. And one of its old names was a masked bed bug hunter, and it does feed on bed bugs. So there you've got a predator. The only trouble is the predator bites people too, and it's a real painful bite. So biological control, I think what we get down to here is people are going to have a zero tolerance for bed bugs. And biological control usually doesn't work on a zero-sum basis. Usually it's a balance between the predators and the prey. And so as I said, nothing has really lent itself, from what we understand of the bedbug biology, to get it in this kind of balance. And as I said, when things are going their way, they Over a period of 3 to 6 months, are very prolific. The females are laying 3 eggs a day. They're doing that for 2 or 3 months. So you can see that you can have an awful lot of offspring. And as I said, predators just don't seem to be able to keep up in the short run.
All right. There you go. Thank you for calling, Gary. Jim from UW Waukesha emailed in about the diatomaceous earth. He says some places, some sources list it as a carcinogen, so handle with care.
Yeah, what the concern silica. There is, yeah, you know, you get silica in your lungs, and there's a problem called silicosis.
Yeah.
And so there's a problem that, you know, and this goes again back to reading the labels. The labels will give you cautions and the like. And so, I mean, everything has a hazard. And, you know, you have to understand that. This case, as I said, with a little precaution. I mean, if somebody were applying it and there was a lot of dust, you could use a breathing mask. You know, you just don't want to get the stuff in your lungs. That's where the concern would be with this product.
Let's turn to Robert in South Milwaukee next. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Morning.
I had some success with borax crystals with insects, but that's not why I called. I'm calling because I'd like your opinion on whether you think the Aedes aegypti or the Aedes albopictus will be able to make it up into our territory, or are we protected by the frost?
Kind of protected by the frost, but we find Albopictus has been found in southern Chicago, so it's not that far away.
And what is it?
These are both very efficient disease vector mosquitoes, things like yellow fever and dengue and the like. And so they're more tropical, especially Aegypti is a real stinker in tropical climates. They're having problems in Florida and elsewhere. Albopictus is the Asian tiger mosquito that has been in the United States now for about 20 years, and it's become a big stinker in the southeast. Dominant day-biting mosquito and the like. But as I said, it just seems... But we just got the Japanese rock pool mosquito, which is Aedes japonicus, found in Wisconsin about 3 or 4 years ago. And it's very like Albopictus, in it breeds in containers around people's homes, and it is a more efficient vector of West Nile, among other things. And so, you know, this has been a discussion for quite some time. As the climate changes, it does have an effect on insects. And one of the predictions is we will have more human disease issues because we're allowing some of these more tropical insects to go farther north. And, you know, I know you've heard me say this before on the show that the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. But, you know, I definitely have seen so many cases of things that were more southern start to edge up this way because really the lack of cold weather. You know, it's 20 below, it's 30 below. These are kind of magic numbers. And, you know, we get cold now, but we don't get that cold. And that, I think, is what's allowing many of these things to move up. So far, no Asian tiger mosquito. And it may be 3 or 4 decades. But if the climate continues to warm, it will be here.
So we are cursed to live in interesting times. Huh?
Yeah.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Robert. Appreciate it. Susan in Bristol, on to you. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an identification thing that I was hoping you could help me with. I have found two of these little critters, different things. And one of them was, excuse me, one of them was really beautiful, and the other one was like a little scary, all right? The scary one I saw on my bathroom wall one time. It was this little spider, and he was black. He was only like maybe a quarter of an inch wide. And he had little claws on him. And I put my finger up toward him, like, to poke him, just make him move. And he kind of lurched at me like he was going to attack me. And I was sure. Times bigger than him.
Yeah, it's called a pseudoscorpion, so it's not a true spider. It's a unique group of arthropod. They don't get very big. They act like a big bully, but they're totally harmless to people. They honestly are predators on things like ants and carpet beetles and other things. So they're really kind of good to have around. And most people don't see them.
I didn't kill them.
Good.
I didn't kill them.
Yeah. So it's a critter called, they said pseudoscorpion is the common name given to that group. And we do find them indoors and nothing to worry about.
Okay. No, and I wasn't worried about it. I just thought it was really cool and didn't know what it was. And the other one is the same thing. It was... I was outside with my mom, and I found this, what appeared to be a ladybug, except it was bright, shining gold, like a piece of jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it in a jar and, like, kept it there for a while, and my mom says, I said, what are we going to do with them? And she says, why don't you let them go, and so we'll make more.
Okay. Well, that turns out to be a type of leaf beetle that we call a tortoise beetle, because they're shaped like a turtle with a shell on the top. There's one particular species that when it's happy is like a piece of molten gold. When it is not happy, it's like a mood ring. Over a period of about 2 or 3 minutes, it changes to a burnt, kind of dark orange. And so the colors vary. And once they die, you can't retain the color because it's metabolic is how it's caused. There's some other tortoise beetles that have some bright silver to them. That particular tortoise beetle you find on morning glory. You find it on bindweed, which is a type of morning glory, and once in a great while on potatoes. And so I do see it, not in big numbers, but they're a real neat creature. If you've never seen one, it just, it's hard to believe an insect can be that bright and beautiful, but they definitely are.
Yeah.
It looked like a piece of jewelry. These two things were just so cool. I had to call to see if you could identify it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Susan, for calling. Tim in Algoma. It is going to be your turn in just a minute, but I want to remind everybody that Phil Pelletieri is our guest today. Phil's a UW Extension entomologist talking about the world of insects here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. And now we'll turn to Tim in Algoma. Tim, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I have a question. I was a Florida resident for several years, and we used to have home remedies for, like, the fire ants. We would take hominy grits and dump it all around the where the ants were going in the ground and everything, and the ants would eat the grits, and it would expand in their stomachs and kill the fire ants. And I was wondering if anybody has ever thought of using something like that on the bed bugs or something like to get rid of those. And,
to be honest, the research I've seen on the hominy grits has not looked it doesn't seem to work. but the problem with the bed bug is they don't, and this is where the boric acid doesn't work. If you understand boric acid, it's a stomach poison, so it's got to be eaten. And bed bugs have a tube-like mouth part they use to suck blood. So when you put the boric acid out in an environment, they never get exposed to it. You know, the only way they feed is to jab it into a person and start pulling out blood. And so it works as a bait. If you've got something like an ant that eats, sugar that's got boric acid in it, that's how it gets it into its stomach. That's how it works against cockroaches. It also works if an insect preens itself. A cockroach will get the crystals on its legs, and then it cleans its antennae and legs, and that's a way of it ingesting. But the bed bug, with its feeding behavior, doesn't get exposed that way. So if you could get it into its stomach, it would kill it very efficiently, but the problem is trying to figure out a way. Hypothetically, if you had a trap that was, we feed bed bugs in some labs in artificial membranes where the blood goes through and they feed through the membrane to get it. Well, you could do the same thing as put boric acid in that and have them feed on it. But I think that would be a very expensive trap to maintain and stuff. So, but good thoughts. They said, people are just coming at this from every direction we can think of, trying to hopefully find a way. And as I said, getting down to it, in some cases, people have almost gotten to the point of hysteria here. I talk to people who are just so concerned about bed bugs, and they're living in situations. If you're living in a single-family home, you're not traveling, people aren't visiting, you're not buying used furniture, there's no way you're going to get bed bugs. And the other side of it is once you get it, if you've got resources, if you get somebody who knows what they're doing, it's a very controllable problem. It's not cheap. It's very controllable. Where we're getting the problems is multifamily housing, where we don't have much in the way of resources. And it's hard to get people to follow the rules. And you put that combination together, and it's a very difficult situation to control.
Let's turn to Mike in Oshkosh next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I've got two issues here. Number one, I have something that's eating the roots off of my house plants. I can tell. It must be extremely tiny because I can't see it at a glance. And they kind of like just they lose their roots.
Boy, that sounds more like a disease. We do have fungus gnats that will do that. But then I think your complaint would be we have lots of little gnats flying around and you'd see little white worms. They're big enough to see. But if the roots seem to be decaying and disappearing, as I said, I think you've got some kind of root rot, whether it's Rhizoctonia or Phytophthora. Sometimes you get a little bit of relief there by lessening the amount of water you give. But I think you need to look into this because it sounds like they're being held in a condition that, as I said, is promoting the root rots. And, boy, that'll kill them given time.
Okay. Yeah. The other thing, if I may quickly, I've got a neighbor that doesn't take care of his swimming pool very well. It's getting kind of green. He makes a half-hearted attempt.
And we didn't want to throw any poison into his pool when he wasn't looking. But what we did do is we threw four goldfish in there to knock down the mosquito larvae, and it seems to work. What do you think about that?
Oh, great idea. In fact, we had a student that was working with top-feeding minnows for the same type of purpose. If you've got fish that feed on small creatures, that's a way you can prevent a pond from becoming a mosquito breeder and the like. And, yeah, you know, it's interesting that, you know, when this West Nile thing was sweeping through the country, the problems in Arizona, in parts of California, say, well, they're too dry, where they don't have marshes and places to flood. But what they found, they were often pools that were not kept up. And, you know, clean water is not good for mosquitoes, but it starts to get green and slimy, and they're happy as heck. And so here you've got the worst kind of mosquitoes as far as disease transmission breeding right in your backyard. And so it is important to try to either drain those things or put something in the water. And, again, a fish was a great solution.
Yep, there you go. Thanks very much for calling. And Peter emailed, wonders, why do paper wasps seem to go crazy and fall? They fight with each other and often fall to the ground locked in combat.
Well, it could be combat, or it could be the rites of spring.
Even in the fall.
Well, see, they work on a different system. In paper wasps, all summer long, they're all females. And in the fall of the year, the males are produced for the first time. And they go through a mating with the new queens. And then the queen is what overwinters and starts the colony. So the only time you find males and the only time you have mating in both bumblebees and paper wasps is in the late summer. And so I have a feeling it was that.
Mating.
Now, on the other hand, you can have competing colonies, and maybe they got into a little bit of a tussle there. But as I said, my first guess would be it was a mating pair there that was going on.
Don in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Don.
Yes, hi. A couple questions quick. On those bed bug things, do those lighted flea traps with the stickum work on bed bugs?
No.
And a while ago, they talked about bees were disappearing, and I was wondering if they found out why they were disappearing and found out a way to start bringing them back.
Okay. Well, first, the bed bugs are attracted by carbon dioxide and to some degree heat. And so you're finding traps on the market now that either use dry ice or some other variations to draw them. They're using this more as a monitoring technique than a control technique. And so, and there is even some expensive traps you can get that, you know, you put a carbon dioxide cylinder in it and it's got a heater and it's got a sticky trap like that. It costs you $300. And as I said, even for monitoring, it takes a week or more to really make sure what's going on. So we haven't got anything that's really very good, but it definitely is going to be carbon dioxide related. The bee thing, we're getting closer. You know, some people think there definitely seems to be a virus that's involved here. There definitely seems to be stress factors and other things. The amount of colony collapse has been less in the last year or two compared to the real problem year. So they're getting closer, and it's more of a management thing. I think if you've got happy, non-stressed, healthy bees, the chance of these complications are far less. But it's not so simple. As I said, there's some people that believe there's a Nosema disease that works in conjunction with the virus and the like. So it's a very complex story. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, small-scale beekeepers that don't transport their bees have a much better success rate with it. And the bees have lots of other problems, the mite problems and the like. I mean, when you look at the decline in honeybees, there's a number of reasons. And bees are not the easiest thing to manage and are becoming more difficult as we keep introducing all these exotic diseases and pests that bother our honeybees. So it will be a constant struggle. But I will say, I guess, sometimes the press tended to maybe misrepresent exactly what the loss was. Now, you could say if we lost all the bees, it would be absolutely horrendously terrible. But there's no indication of that. And as I said, some states have not suffered near the losses. The biggest losses have been the people that migrate their bees from Florida to California for almond production. And that's a lot of stress. And then if the bees have got the virus and other things, they get in trouble.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And John in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. This is about bed bugs.
Okay.
Would it be possible to, or how long would it take to starve them out? Just leave the room, the bedroom, don't use it for, 6 months or a year? how often do they have to eat to survive?
It's interesting. You know, a lot of the early literature suggested that bedbugs could survive upwards of a year without feeding. One of the researchers that was presenting at the meeting said his feeling is after 3 months, they're going to be in pretty big trouble. The trouble is they migrate. And so if you had the bedroom, you know, and nothing left that bedroom, I can't guarantee you the bedbugs won't come crawling out looking for something to eat when they get hungry. And so it because they can stay for an extended period of time. I mean, other insects, 2 weeks and they're toast, but not in the case of bedbugs. The other reason why you see the conflicting reports is it depends on temperature and humidity. Basically, cooler and damp, they live longer. You know, because they have desiccation problems and the like. So they said you have to look at all these factors involved. But easily 3 months, 6 months wouldn't surprise me. And as I said, to starve them out, if you left the house completely and didn't come back for a couple years. But interesting enough, even though they don't thrive, we find that they'll feed on cats, dogs, other animals, given the opportunity just to sustain themselves.
So there you have it. You'd have to turn your temperature up in the house to 115 or so, and that might get
rid of Then you get them pretty quick.
Then you get them pretty quick. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. He'll be with us till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, talking about insects with Phil. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along. All our lines are filled right now, but I'm sure there'll be some open pretty soon. Arthur emailed wondering, Phil, what's wrong with using DDT as an indoor bedbug control? He says it was banned because of human misuse, but bedbugs will become a worldwide pest if not controlled.
Well, interesting enough, DDT has largely looked at the reason why bedbugs became so infrequent in the last 5 or 6 decades. But one of the first cases of insect resistance was in 1947 to bedbugs being resistant to DDT. And we know for a fact now that one of the reasons our pyrethroid chemicals don't work is they have the same mode of action site as DDT. So we know the bedbugs are resistant to it, and that's why our chemicals aren't working very well. And so, you know, it was interesting to look at, and, you know, that question has been looked at close enough. And as I said, the bottom line is most of the populations are resistant to it already, so it really wouldn't make much of a difference.
Just got something from Jim Packard, brought me in something called Bed Bug Boot Camp. And it's at Western Technical College, lifelong learning, and it's well, it's for hotel owners, for landlords, college managers, movie theaters, and so forth. And it's bed bug biology, policies and practices to prevent or limit it, so forth and so on. December. Well, some of these are already gone by, but January 11th at La Crosse, and a couple of sessions there for $45 a person.
Yeah, there is a big bedbug summit again. I think some people had seen the big bedbug conference down in Chicago this past fall. There is a big bedbug summit in Denver the early part of January, where again, and some of the things that are being discussed is they're using dogs to find bedbugs and the like, and they're very good, the detector dogs. But there's got to be some way of certifying those dogs, because there's an interesting article in the New York Times about 3 weeks ago of people that we're having dogs that wag their tail. They assume they had bed bugs, spent thousands of dollars to control, and you get there and they didn't have bed bugs. And so, you know, that's a problem. There's even some discussion about certification of pest control technicians to be bed bug certified as competent, so that there's, you know, a kind of a standard procedure to go through. You know, what I've seen there, I guess, is people have gotten experience, they've gotten better. I always tell people, if you have to have professional help here. I really think this is a problem you can't solve yourself. But if you go that direction, you know, make sure that the person you're working with has got some bed bug experience. And something like this is very good, I think, for hotel people and the like, you know, to get geared up, to know what to look for. Because we do know the quicker you catch it, the earlier in the infestation, the higher the likelihood of success.
So that's at Western Technical College, and just go to westerntech.edu, and you'll find out all you need to, all you need to do. Let's see, it's Western. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Western TC. So spread out westerntc.edu, and you can probably learn. I'm sure you'll be able to learn about it.
Another site, if people really want to get into this,
I should also say there's a phone number. Let me get that phone number. It's 608-785-9553. 608-785-9553.
There's a gentleman on the internet that has something called Bedbug TV. And he has about 60 episodes on YouTube, and they're really very well done. He's a pest control operator out east. His name is Charlie White, and he does information segments on using heat, using ozone, what to do in a hotel, you know, and he keeps these updated. He puts one up about every 2 weeks and such, and so as I said, I'm finding it. You always got to be careful on the internet, but I've found the material that he has presented really has been kind of very educational and very unbiased. You know, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, and let people make some decisions from there.
And where do you go for that again?
Just if you do a search on Bedbug TV, it will show up. It's his site.
Let's go to Tom in Oregon next. Tom, hello.
Larry, a great program as usual.
Thanks.
Just had a question about more friendly bugs. I'm a novice beekeeper and just wondering if Phil would have any advice for a novice beekeeper as far as keeping bees and keeping them healthy.
Okay, well, beekeeping is not my expertise. I guess, though, with just watching, so much of it seems to be the problem. From what I'm hearing from people, is the mite problem in particular is difficult to manage, and so trying to keep ahead of that. In particular, in the normal winter, we lose about 30% of our bees from a variety of things. Not enough honey, the colonies being too weak going in the winter. And then again, we put this whole litany of mite problems and the like. So I think that's the general direction of going, is I find that people that are hobbyists that kind of care for them like you would your dog, really babysit them, watch them closely. And kind of react to that kind of stuff are the people that have the best success. But as I said, I'll be honest with you, that it is not.
your
I know
area.
A bit about beekeeping, but it's not my strength. So.
Okay, there we go. Thanks, Tom. Joel in Antigo. Hi, Joel.
Howdy. My question for you today, Paul, is in regards to deer ticks and protecting ourselves against Lyme disease. Our area has an awful lot of sled doggers. And the dogs themselves seem to be, plagued with the Lyme disease because of their exposures. And I'm finding myself, when I go bird hunting, even working in people's yards, I'll pick up a lot of deer ticks. I think there were so far was like 23 from one spot. And I've been using the pyrethrins or permethrins on my clothes. They seem to work pretty well. I'm wondering if there's any organics that you are aware of that offer a similar protection and something that could possibly be sprayed on the dogs as well to help offset the vet costs that some of these sled doggers are looking
sure.
at.
Well, the problem is there are some organic oils that will kill bed bugs on contact, but they don't have residual.
Okay.
So that's the advantage of the permethrin is that, on a pair of jeans, if it's not washed, that stuff lasts for 2 to 3 weeks easily. On the dog, again, it's a little bit dependent on how much water the dog's exposed to, because these things do tend to wash off. And of course, they've got things like Frontline and other products that are there. But as I said, the organics do have efficacy, but the problem is I don't know of any organics that have residual.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thank you for calling. Tom in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hey. Hi, Larry. Good show here. I'm learning more about bugs than I never thought I would ever know. Especially the bed bug convention. I'm wondering how many bed bugs go to that type of thing. anyways, more seriously, these, I don't know what you call them, bombs, I'm going to call them aerosol bombs that you can put in a room and release them, and they just give off a big cloud of whatever that stuff is. You got to leave the house. You can't have any pets, of course. But would that work on bed bugs at all?
No, in fact, it's a mis. I think a misuse might be a way of putting it. When you look at what's going on, the problem is people think that when you set a bomb off, it penetrates in your walls and it kills everything that's in there. But the only thing it kills is what's out in your living space, what it settles on, and so you're basically putting small amounts of residual everywhere, but not in the right place. And so, as I said, we find the bombs. And this is one of the conversations, again, we have about concerns about people trying to self-treat is, you know, we've had cases, but people are getting exposed to a lot of pesticide and not getting any advantage. A lot of those things also have fire hazards associated with them. You know, if you have a spark when one goes off. And so, no, that's not the direction. And you'll find if you call professional help in, that's not the kind of products they're going to be using.
There you go. Thank you. John in Green Bay. Hello.
Hello. Quick question here. No bed bugs.
Okay.
I've got a small insect living in house plants, apparently in the soil. It's a bit smaller than a fruit fly. They seem to crawl around on the top of the soil. They're perhaps a large one, is an eighth of an inch. They look like they got four wings. And I'm just wondering if you got any idea what we may be dealing with here.
Okay, the wing thing, at first I thought you had springtails, which are a very common soil-inhabiting creature, but there's no such thing as a winged springtail. If it was something like a fungus gnat, which could breed in potting soil, it only has two wings. Okay. If it has four wings, to be honest, then I start getting suspicious of aphids, but then you would think you'd see aphids on the green part of the plant.
There's nothing on the green part. They seem to be doing nothing with the plants. When I water the plants, I see them running along the top more, yet they do fly.
Yeah, I think those are fungus gnats. And what they have is a little tiny maggot that's living in the soil, feeding on the organic matter. Okay. Once in a while, they'll feed a little bit on roots, but generally speaking, they don't harm the plant much, but they do cause a nuisance because the little gnats can, you know, if you're sitting drinking a cup of coffee, one can dive bomb into the coffee or get in your eye. I mean, that's the big problem.
They seem to fly into water. If you forget the water sprinkler can there, you get up in the morning or whatever, you got two or three in the water.
Okay, well,
a solution.
There is this would be an organic solution, and honestly, it's very effective. There is a bacterium that they sell. I know it's sold commercially under the name Nat Out or Natrol. But it is a special bacterium, and you will see forms of this in the larger garden stores, and it's a powder or a liquid that you just put on the soil surface, and it kills the maggots. And if you kill the maggots, you stop the life cycle. It won't kill the adults, but interesting enough, it only kills maggots. It wouldn't kill an aphid. It wouldn't kill a beetle. So it's a very selective product, and again, because it's selective, it is much safer than in a broader spectrum type of treatment. So it's a little hard to find, although easy again on the internet to get it. And as I said, if you've got a big garden store, getting some of this. The official name of the product is BTI, which stands for Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. It's a strain of BT that kills maggots. And so that's one solution. There are other kinds of more broad spectrum things that can be drenched. What I'll tell you, though, is that the liquid-based products tend to cause some root pruning. Usually powders and dusts, when they're watered in, tend to cause less root problems. So
that was Nat Out?
Nat Out or Natrol, Gnatrol, are two of the names that I've seen it sold under.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yep, you too. Thanks for calling, John. And Mark in Elkhorn, hello to you.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question about, I have these, they're like, I don't know if they're centipedes. I think they are centipedes, but they're really light and fast, and they have like 100 legs or so. And they show up, you know, around like the chimney and brick area of my home. Tends to be more when there's like moisture. You know, if we just had a really good rain, they show up. And I'm wondering what there is out there to get rid of these things. I believe they're predators.
Yes.
Just because, you know, they're so fast. And I don't know of anything that's that fast that isn't.
Right.
They're really hard to catch and kill.
Right. It turns out you're right about the moisture. They seem to thrive better. And because centipedes can have access to wall voids and attic spaces, they're kind of in places you can't get to, but then they come cruising around looking for food, and that's when they show up in the kitchen. A passive trap that works are these glue boards, which are basically a sticky cardboard trap that some people use for catching mice. They're smaller versions, but if you put that back in corners and out of the way, and if you've got pets, you got to be careful because you don't want the pet to get in the glue board. But when the centipede crawls across, it gets caught. And what you find is that usually you're dealing with a small number, but as you say, you can't catch them so that you never get rid of them per se. So you don't have to catch very many to reduce the numbers. They do respond to ant sprays, but the same thing, you got to spray them back in the cracks and crevices where they're hiding rather than out in the front of the kitchen floor, which wouldn't be very effective. So they said glue boards is one thought. Drying things out helps a little bit. Getting rid of clutter helps a little bit. But even if you had a perfectly clean, dry house, that doesn't mean you can't have a centipede. So as I said, changing the environment helps a little bit, but I like the glue board solution.
So are they also kind of like territorial? They're going to be limited because I'm guessing they prey on other insects similar to spiders. And if you have so many in an area, they just won't survive because they're in competition with each other for insects.
Right, and they'll eat each other. I mean, they're enough of a predator that they'll pick on smaller, anything weaker they'll feed on. So,
okay.
So as I said, you usually are, because there's not a lot of insects in the normal house to eat, these things are relatively slow to breed. You're never totally overrun with them. But on the other hand, even seeing one a month is enough to send most of the family screaming and running. So I understand how people want to take care of them. So,
okay, thank you. I'll try those glue boards maybe.
All right, give it a shot. We have someone who emailed in, Stan emailed in, and said that listeners can check for bed bug problems at specific motels and hotels by going to bedbugregistry.com, bedbugregistry.com. I just went there and looked online here and list a lot of hotels and motels. You can literally click on the on one part of the country where you might be going, and it'll show up the hotels that have and motels that have shown up with bed bug issues.
Well, the interesting thing to me would be if they've got the stuff dated, because if a hotel had a problem and had it treated correctly, it should be clean. And so, you know, it is a way of kind of saying, it's interesting in New York, they've changed the lease laws now so that the landlord has to make you aware that this unit has had problems in the last 2 years, I think it is. And this may be something we're going to see nationwide for people because, as I had mentioned before, multiple family housing is more problematic because they migrate from one unit to the next. And so it's not just the one unit. And that's why it's easier in a single-family home is you've got them surrounded. They can't be coming from anywhere else, and they can't go anywhere else either.
Let's take some more calls here, going to Bill in Oshkosh. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling. Bill, are you there? Did we lose Bill? Must have lost Bill. Let's go to Bill in Silver Lake. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Part of my profession involves killing bugs as well. And one of the products that I've used is called imidacloprid. It's actually used for grub control. I was surprised to find out that it's also used on a lot of our pets, and this intrigued me, and I'm a geek, so I started looking into it more. I understand that there has been some clinical trials on people as far as controlling mosquitoes. Why do we... Well, I don't understand what the holdup is on using this product. I understand how it works. It doesn't really have any effect on mammals whatsoever, let alone people. Why can't we use this as a way of controlling mosquitoes and bed bugs and things like that? I mean, I know it's not the most appealing thing to put pesticides on us, but we use permethrin to get rid of lice and sure. other types of shampoos.
Well, to be
What's
honest,
the problem with imidacloprid?
Well, two things. There are formulations that are now a combination of a pyrethroid and a neonicotinoid. Which is that the kind of chemical. This is a kind of a synthetic version of nicotine. It does have problems in people. I mean, if you get exposed enough to it, it does. It's a neurotoxin, so you got to be careful. But so there are products already registered for commercial pest control companies. You know, Temprid and whatnot are examples of one of these nicotinoid pyrethroid combinations. But interesting enough, these chemicals are far better for insects that suck the juices out of plants and aren't quite as good. Like, they don't kill caterpillars very well. And to be honest, the research data on bed bugs is they don't ingest it. They don't get it in their body very easily. Unlike a cockroach that has a lot of its surface area that is in contact with when it walks, so it's absorbing a lot of pesticide that way. One of the weird things about bed bugs is they don't have these large pads and other things on their legs. And bed bugs are kind of walking on their tippy toes. And because they're walking on their tippy toes, they don't get exposed to the chemicals that are on a surface. So, as I said, these things have been looked at and they work to some degree, but they're definitely not the magic bullet. And now, if you got them into people so it was in your blood, maybe, but then you've got a nerve poison in you. And so, as I said, that isn't going to happen. On dogs, it's more of a topical treatment. And that's how it works is through the oil glands on the surface. And you've got to be careful there because there have been problems in small dogs and certain breeds that have sensitivities to this. So, as I said, a good thought, and it is a very effective product. That's what they're using for killing emerald ash borer in trees. It has a great grub control, but it doesn't have as broad a spectrum insect killing power as some of the other chemicals that are out there.
There you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Earl, going back to bees for just a minute, Earl was responding to our hobby beekeeper or novice beekeeper who phoned earlier, and he says, and he's right, you can get good information about bees and bee protection and bee care through the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. They've got a website, and I know that website, and there's a lot of really good information there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and if you're lucky enough to have somebody in the neighborhood that's keeping bees that's had some experience, they said there's nothing greater because there's an art to keeping bees.
Yeah.
And so if you've got somebody that's been through the wars, I think they can give you. And, you know, people sometimes have differences of opinion on what works and what doesn't work. But generally, somebody's been through it at least can tell you what's worked for them.
On to Jean in Rice Lake. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I'm interested in the camel spider, which is found in Iraq. I know they get really big. What can you tell me about them?
A lot of the information on the internet isn't quite true. They talk about how toxic they are. They're not even a true spider. They're a sulpigid, which is a different kind of creature. Look big, mean, and ugly, and they're really relatively harmless. They're just big and ugly looking is kind of the best way to put it. And I'm not so sure I'd put my finger in front of their jaws. But as I said, there's nothing that's innately dangerous about them. But I have seen information on the internet that really would give you the impression that they eat small children and kill people and stuff, and that's just not true.
How big do they get?
Well, you know, it's one of these things that has very long legs. And so if you put one out, I would say you can get things in the neighborhood of 18 to 20 inches quite easily, which is a pretty big creature when you think about it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Rick in New London. Hello to you.
Hello. Good afternoon, sir. Hey, I'm curious. So, what's the status on the Emerald Ash Borer situation? Do you have a quarantine area, and have you ever thought of anything to get rid of them?
Well, we're not going to get rid of them. What they're trying to do is slow the spread, and I think, you know, stepping back this year, if you were to ask me last spring how many counties we're going to have that we'd find new Emerald Ash Borer infestations, I'd say I bet you two or three. We had none.
No.
Some of the infestations have gotten a little bigger. We've had added places in West Bend and in the Milwaukee area. We found new places within the quarantine area. In discussions, again, at our national meetings, we were talking to the people that were working up in the Upper Peninsula with the infestation up by Houghton. And, you know, that one was 7 years old before they found it. And this seems to be the pattern, is when we find them, they've been bubbling for quite some time. But once you get on them and start to understand it, they're moving so far relatively slowly. And so that part's been encouraging. Now, you know, we've only got a couple years' experience, so it's not as if we understand everything. But I think the bottom line that I have been encouraged at is that when you find these infestations and start to work with them, we can slow them from moving out. And that ultimately means that it's going to take a lot longer to have the problem statewide, hopefully. But again, we got to pay attention to moving firewood and all the other ways, because you can goof up the system very quickly by just taking the wrong two pieces of firewood and driving two counties over and drop them off, and all of a sudden we got an infestation there.
So. Yeah. What about gypsy moths?
The gypsy moth numbers, you know, we had a lot of disease problems because of the wet spring. That was good. But the final analysis, when we saw the numbers, they were similar to the year previous. Now, you know, some of these are moth catches. I have not seen any egg surveys yet. So the good news is that we had a lot of disease. I mean, in the Madison area, a lot of the gypsy moths just shriveled up and died from the fungus disease. But the final moth catches from the Department of Ag and DNR were, again, to me, a little bit surprising. I thought they were going to be lower than that. But they're now evaluating the areas they've got to treat. I know there will be areas that they treat. There was quite a bit of defoliation up in Marionette, and in those areas, there was also a little pocket over in Columbia County. So we did have a couple places where we had some problems.
Phil, always a pleasure. Look forward to your next visit next year.
Sounds good.
All right. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and he'll be back next year, and we'll do this all over again with him. Just coming up tomorrow, Phil might be interested in this one. Richard Kniff, author of The Species Seeker, great new book. We'll talk with him about that tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.